You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And for Dear Science this week, we are joined once again by our expert, Professor Alan Bickman. Good afternoon.
Or just professor, you know.
Yeah.
Expert professor, is that a new title?
Expert professor. Well, I mean, expert was the word I was given. I mean, it must be, we're closing in on a year now, right? That I've been...
Oof. Actually, it has been a while since we've had a change. We're going through posts like, hot knife through butter usually, but no, this is all good. We've got some stability here.
Okay? Yeah, and it's been a year, and I think I was gifted the word expert upon beginning, and I've just called you an expert. You are an expert in contrast.
Somebody's been having you on, probably.
And what kind of science are we hearing about today? There's a nuclear fusion record.
There is, yeah. But there's also a birthday today.
A big birthday?
Not a big birthday, because the guy sadly is passed on, but it is Lev Andreyevich Artsimovich's birthday today.
Just rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, if you're Russian, it does. But he was born in 1909, so he's shuffled off this mortal coil by now. He's a Russian physicist, and he's called the father of the tokamak.
Wow. And what is a tokamak?
Yeah, I was hoping you'd ask.
Yeah, because I've got no clue.
Okay, so what's a tokamak? A tokamak is an apparatus that can confine plasmas of ridiculously high temperatures.
Right.
Using magnetic fields.
And why would we want to do that?
Well, we'd want to do that because we want to carry out nuclear fusion on planet Earth, because all of our oil's running out and we need a new source of energy.
Got it.
So Artsimovich was the father of this tokamak thing. And as I said, what it does is it confines plasmas, and plasmas at ridiculous temperatures. We're talking 50 million degrees.
Okay? That's quite hot.
We're not just talking the hot Auckland afternoon.
Yeah.
50 million degrees, and it can confine that with the use of magnetic fields into this donut-shaped thing called a torus.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah.
And now, why do we need to do this? Okay, so quick physics lesson. The process that powers our sun is a thing called nuclear fusion, as opposed to nuclear fission.
Okay? Which is something else.
So fission is breaking things apart and getting lots of energy,
yep.
And fusion is putting things together and getting lots of energy. And it's far harder to actually put things together
than take them apart.
Right. But the energies that you get when you put things together are just madness.
Much more.
Madness.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
So, and like, we've got the atomic bomb versus the hydrogen bomb, which you may have heard of both.
Yep.
The atomic bomb is a fission bomb. So we're talking uranium nuclei splitting in half or whatever and giving out lots and lots of energy. And the hydrogen bomb is putting hydrogen atoms together.
Right.
To make helium
and other
things.
It's even more powerful.
And in order to get a hydrogen bomb going, you've got to basically ignite it with an atomic bomb.
Oh, okay. So there's a chain of events there.
Very, very, very high energy situations. Mm. So we want to carry out this controlled process on planet Earth.
Yes, okay? for energy.
We can go off letting off hydrogen bombs. Yeah, great. But, you know, that causes a bit of...
Not ideal.
Havoc and destruction. So... the energy in the atomic nucleus is just of ridiculous proportions. Okay, you take a helium nucleus, for example, is made up of two protons and two neutrons. Okay, and if we took 4 grams of helium or 4 grams of those constituents and put them all together to make a helium nucleus, and doing that with that 4 grams, we'd get enough energy to power Sydney for an hour and a half.
Oh, so this is quite a lot. We've got
four grams
of Sydney.
Four grams.
Got it. Okay. This is very efficient.
So we want this. We want to be able to do this controlledly. Obviously, the high temperatures are a bother.
Yep.
So it just happened to be this guy's birthday today, the father of the tokamak, and they've just happened to announce that in a thing called the West Tokamak Reactor in Cadarache in France, which is a beautiful part of France. I've been down there. Oh, it's lovely. And they have been able to maintain a plasma. They've got a new world record for maintaining a plasma of 50 million degrees. And they've kept it for 22 minutes and 17 seconds. So that's a new world record.
Yeah. And I'm assuming that's a bit of a big deal. But what are we aiming for, I guess, here?
What are you aiming for? Well, the process that powers... You know, so this is the process that powers our sun, as I said.
Yeah.
Now, this occurs at the centre of the sun. At the centre of the sun, you've got ridiculous pressures.
Mm.
Okay. massive, massive pressure, you know, just things that we can't get our heads around. And so that process in the middle of the sun operates at 15 million degrees, there or thereabouts, okay,
right.
Roughly. Now, we can't access those pressures on planet Earth.
No.
So in order to get this process going, we've got to get even hotter. We've got to get about 10 times hotter. You've got to get to about 150 million degrees before we can get this process going. And so that's what these folk are aiming for. They're looking at being able to controllably store a plasma at this ridiculously high temperature and ultimately end out the whole process. What they want is to end up getting out more energy than they put in. Because you can imagine heating something up to 150 million
degrees. That does seem
takes a few, you know, 9-volt batteries sort of thing. So that's the goal of the whole thing.
Right.
And it's going to be incrementally small steps.
Yeah.
Obviously. And as somebody once said, nuclear fusion is just 25 years away. But they said that 25 years ago. And they say they say that every year, basically.
Yeah. You know, so we're dealing with a – it's close, but – sort of far, a little bit past the horizon.
Yeah, but as I say, you know, these incremental steps, they're really, really important. And the fact that they can do this, you know, just even this process by itself blows the mind. You know, 50 million degrees. How the hell do you enclose 50 million degrees so it doesn't just immediately obliterate everything around it?
Yeah, how is that done?
Magnetic fields.
Right.
Don't ask me how. I don't
The magnetic fields hold the heat in.
Yeah, basically.
Somehow.
Wow. This is for the high-energy physicists. They know all of this stuff. And this guy, Art Simovich, you know, he was the guy behind all of this.
Yeah.
So there we go. We're another step along the way to control nuclear fusion.
Yeah, incredible stuff.
Yeah.
And then what have we got here about plastic ice?
Plastic ice.
How does that work?
Well, ice. What is ice?
Well, that's just water.
It's
a very simple situation.
It is an extremely simple situation, you would think. You know, you take water, you cool it, you stick it in the freezer, you cool it, that cools, and then magically it turns into ice.
Okay. Had the same situation while on holiday, chucked a bottle of water in the freezer thinking, oh, it'll get colder quicker. A little bit of demonstration. Turned into ice.
Yep. So, and when it turns into ice, it's the most amazing thing. I don't know if you've stopped to think about it, but you've got all these little water molecules at 1 degree Celsius. All these little molecules are running around banging into each other, boom, 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 boom. And then all of a sudden at 0 degrees, they all stop, but they stop in order. And this order is hexagonal. You've got all these water molecules arranged in hexagons, so it ends up looking like a giant honeycomb. This is sort of the way, this is the ice that you get when you just take ordinary water and freeze it at 0 degrees in atmospheric pressure, okay? And you think, yep, so what? Ice is ice, blah-de-blah.
Yep.
No.
We've all seen ice.
Aha, you have. But there are over 20 forms of ice known, 20 different forms.
Right, we probably haven't seen all of those.
And the seriously weird thing is that some of those forms of ice have a melting point above 0 degrees.
Ooh, that's fun.
So they can exist as ice above 0 degrees.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, how the heck can that work?
Well, I am wondering that, but I'm also thinking, how can I get my hands on them?
Well, when we stick our water in the fridge and it turns to ice, we're doing all that at atmospheric pressure, pressure of one atmosphere. Okay, the pressure of the Earth's atmosphere pushing down on us. Now, if we up that a little bit to, let's say, 20,000 atmospheres.
Right. Whereabouts would we have to be?
Well, just in a high-pressure lab.
Right.
That's not difficult to achieve. So it's the equivalent, and I did some calculations here, the equivalent of around about 3.5 full-grown African elements on 1 square centimetre.
Right.
So that's about 20,000 atmospheres.
That's a lot of
it's pressure. That's a lot of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if you do that, then not surprisingly, that has an effect on structure.
Yes.
Because all these poor little atoms are going to get all squeezed and everything to heck.
Yeah, going to move around.
And where they're quite happy being hexagons at atmospheric pressure, if you start pressurizing them up, then they rearrange and they go cubic.
Ooh.
They go all sort of Rubik's Cube type arrangements now, okay?
It's some funky looking ice.
And with that change in structure comes changes in properties, particularly melting points and boiling points, and indeed other things. So if we use this 20,000 times atmospheric pressure, we then get a thing called ice 7. Now the ice that you get in the freezer is ice 1,
that makes sense,
or in fact ice 1h, for hexagonal,
right?
Okay.
Oh, perfect.
Now we get ice 7.
Mm-hmm.
And ice 7 has been known for nearly 100 years, actually. Oh. It's, yeah, it's you know.
So I'm late to the game.
Yeah. We're not. We're dealing with a known quantity here. Yeah.
And what people do these days is they play around on computers because computers can do amazing things that we can't.
Yep.
And they look at the structures of these things and ask the computer, well, if I did this, what would happen to that sort of thing? And it had been theorized or proposed from computer studies that if you took this ice-7 and you pressurized it even more and heated it up to around about 300 degrees.
Ice-8?
300 degrees. close. You then get ice-7 plastic.
Ah.
And this is the weird thing because now what we've got... So these calculations foresaw that you're going to get something that behaves a little bit like a solid and a little bit like a liquid.
Mm.
Now, what makes a solid... the fact that all of your constituents, all your molecules, all your atoms, they're all in one particular place and they don't move.
Yes.
Okay, so they're in defined positions in space and those arrangements go on in three dimensions for infinity. Okay,
yep.
So these definite arrangements and immovable. That's why solids are hard.
Yeah.
Liquids, on the other hand...
not so.
All your molecules can move around a little bit, okay? So they're fine. So... they predicted that this thing should behave like a solid, but also like a liquid. In other words, end up like a sort of a plastic.
Right.
And that's indeed what they found. So they did these very, very high-level studies, and they showed that, yep, you pressurize it even more. You pressurize it to 60,000 atmospheres an hour and about 300 degrees.
Mm.
And you still get this cubic arrangement of them. So they're all sort of in the Rubik cube arrangement. But now what they can do is they can rotate. They can rotate around, and that gives it a certain sort of plasticity. So they're not absolutely solid.
I'm guessing nobody got to like touch it and
no,
because it'd be too.
No, you're absolutely right there. Yes,
but it would be nice to look at.
Yeah. So, and as I said, you know, there's 20 different forms of ice, and I'm sure there'll be more that are discovered.
Find some more.
Yeah.
Lots of new ice.
This is what people do in high pressure labs. So yeah.
And then lastly, we've got aromatherapy. Linked to pollution.
Yeah, not quite sure how I feel about this one. But I sort of came across this and everything. We all love our smells, don't we? We all like things to smell nice.
Yep, big fan of smells.
And, you know, you're out in the forest or, you know, out in the bush or whatever and things smell absolutely lovely and there's nothing like the smell of pine needles in Naseby in the middle of summer.
Well, I've got pretty bad hay fever, so there's some things that are nicer, but it's not bad.
But that to me is a very evocative smell.
Yes, it's a great smell.
That brings back childhood holidays and everything like that. But, so of course we want those smells in our home, don't we?
Yes.
We want our homes to smell nice, so let's...
make smells.
Exactly. So, you know, let's have things fragrant. Let's have nice sort of air fresheners that are fragrant and let's have, you know, deodorants that are fragrant and blah, 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 blah. So a bunch of workers over at Purdue University in Indiana in the States, they built a tiny home to try and replicate what's going on with all of the air in your real-sized home.
Okay? Right.
So on a smaller scale.
Yes, they built a small house.
And so they were trying to mimic the features of a typical home and... what they found, quite worryingly actually, is that if you've got these nice sort of scented things, and in particular, wax melts. Anybody know what a wax melt is?
Dealing with a candle-like situation?
Yes, indeed, apparently. But you put it in one of those sort of machines that sort of evaporates it sort of thing.
Getting lots of wax in the air.
Yeah. And so what apparently happens is that you get these odor molecules in the air, and they can react with ozone.
Ooh.
Now, ozone normally is in the upper atmosphere.
Yeah.
Down at ground level, there's not too much ozone floating around, unless you're near electrical appliances. So if you've ever spent a lot of time close to an old-style photocopier, for example, you'll know that slightly biting smell as ozone.
Right.
And ozone's really, really reactive, and what it can do is it can react with these odor molecules and it can form horrors nanoparticles.
Ooh, what's a nanoparticle?
Nanoparticle is a very, very small particle.
Yep.
Okay, very, very, very small piece of solid. And the bad thing about nanoparticles, they do a lot of amazing things, but if you get them into your lungs, then chances are it's not the best thing for you. You don't want tiny little things in your lungs.
Is it like a killing you situation or like a surgery hospital situation?
Very possibly a lung cancer-y type,
okay.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and again, like things like smoking and stuff like that. So chances are there's particulate material that goes into your lungs and, you know,
causes
you problems 20 years down the track. So we don't want that. And so what they show showed is that these particular odor molecules can in fact react with ozone. They can form nanoparticles in the air, and then if you start inhaling them, then that might not be a good thing. Now, this is all speculation at the moment, right, in terms of the health effects and stuff like that. I think what they have shown is that, yes, you can get nanoparticles in the air as a result of these things evaporating.
Okay? Right.
But, you know, don't go bloody trashing all over.
There's no evidence of risk. Yeah.
There's not yet, yeah. Okay? So all that they've done is just shown that, you know, this is the case.
Hmm.
The media outlets have picked it up, and hopefully they're not sort of, you know, amplifying the potential risk beyond whatever that might be at the moment anyway. But, you know, as is the case with so many stories on Dear Science, more study is necessary. You know?
Yeah, we've got to see more. And we've got to see more maybe in the future, because this is it for this week's Dear Science. But thank you for coming on, Alan.
Pleasure.
Thank you, as always, Mojat. And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.